Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're starting the show today by talking about a new cookbook out. It's called The Steger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. And our guests are the authors, Will Steger and Rita Mae Steger. Will is a well-known Arctic explorer and environmentalist. Will, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Larry. Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks for being with us. Rita Mae is Will's niece and the chef at the homestead, and she created many of the recipes in the book. And Rita Mae, welcome to you. Good to see you.
Hi, you too. Thank you.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What do you have, what questions do you have about a hearty meal, cooking one? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about the Steger Homestead, and you may have questions about that as well, or maybe you visited once upon a time. And if you have, I sure hope you'll call in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Will, you've certainly had an adventurous life. I loved reading about it in the start of the book, and then kind of throughout. It's sprinkled, there are some pages sprinkled through the book about some of your experiences. But tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, I was raised in the city of Minneapolis. I went to school at the University of St. Thomas, got my degrees in science and a master's of education. I taught school in the city for 3 years in the 60s. But I bought wilderness property when I was 19 back in 64 with the idea of moving through the wilderness after I finished my college and got some teaching experience. And during that time also I did expeditions. I've been doing major expeditions for 60 years now. But in 1970, when I was 25, I left the city and all my friends and moved to the wilderness, 3 miles from the nearest road, north of Ely on the edge of the Boundary Waters on a small lake. And my goal then, and had always been my goal ever since I was a child, was to live self-sufficiency and build up on my own homestead. You know, we didn't homestead the property, but the homesteading style of self-sufficiency, we cleared land by hand and built up the soil for gardens, incredible organic gardens that we had back then in the early 70s. And we cut ice for our refrigeration and root cellars. We've been doing that for almost 55 years. And we did all the buildings ourselves, the sauna. Just lived that the really good life. But a big part of our life was simple eating, organic. I mean, even back in the late 60s, there was access to grains and beans, and mainly in bulk. It wasn't as commercial as it was now. But we ground our own wheat, made our own yogurt. It's the way people lived in Wisconsin, you know, 100, 120 years ago. But I always aspired to that simple life in the wilderness. My goal as a young kid was to spend my life working outside and putting my mind in that beautiful kind of a spiritual, natural world of the wilderness. And then to make a living, I started a dog sledding and skiing school. And before long, community was always an important part for myself. But, you know, all of a sudden I was isolated here and, you know, where's your friends and so forth. But by building up the school, I drew in a lot of people and a lot of great friends that were instructors with me from our town taught. And this homestead, we called it, this homestead community grew around that. And we have extended community. There's been thousands of people, probably many people from Wisconsin have been up and building the center itself over the last 30, 40 years. A lot of our laborers came from skilled laborers from Wisconsin. But yeah, it's all centered around the homestead, around simplicity and the simple eating, which the cookbook is about.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rita Mae, let's go to turn to you. You've spent every summer since you were a toddler at the homestead. So what, and you come back every year, what keeps bringing you back?
Everything. Mostly it's the community there. We have a huge community of people who come in and out and revisit all the time. It's also the nature, being able to escape the city and be out there for a few months at a time every year is really important.
And you travel a lot. Talk about your travels, where you've gone, how other cultures may have influenced your recipes, and I can certainly see that in some of your recipes.
Yeah, I grew up traveling to Vietnam also every summer with my mom. That's where she's from. So I grew up, I feel like I grew up on airplanes, just going back to visit my family. But also as an adult, I've done a lot of backpacking, lots of time in the California mountains. And mostly a lot of time in Vietnam and eating with whoever it is we meet along the way.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And so, and your love of cooking, how did that develop?
So I definitely get that from my own mom, just seeing her create food for my entire life. Food is a huge part of my family and how we all get together. In Vietnam, they ask you, have you eaten yet? Instead of asking how you're doing, you know, everything is revolved around food, everything.
That's pretty cool. Will, you wrote in the book that gardening is like being on an expedition. I thought it was kind of cool. Well, explain that.
Yeah, gardening, I mean, in the expedition, you're always in the moment. I mean, that's how you keep safe, is being aware of what's going on around you. And the gardening is the same thing. It's an investment. All of a sudden, when you have a big garden out, you're real cognizant of the weather conditions. You make that investment. You have frost coming in the fall. But more than anything, you're out in a wonderful setting. It could be a wilderness, or it could be your garden in the backyard. But you're there working with your hands in the dirt. You're planting seeds. You're watching it grow. And in doing so, you're aware of the birds and all the animals, everything that's going on around you. And then the really great part is you harvest it, and that harvest that you have is really clean and pure and organic, and you share that with your friends and community. And so it's a incredible thing. I think today we need simplicity more than ever. I think people are so frantic. I think a lot of our problems melt away when we have a garden to work with and commit with and work with other people.
Yeah, I think COVID, that issue resulted in a very large increase in gardening among people. And maybe what you just said is why.
I think people, you know, it was a tough time during COVID for most of us. Isolation and a lot of us lost jobs and so forth. And we live in this frantic world, COVID or no COVID, you know, we have a divided country and all this hassle that we deal with. But I think it was natural in the COVID that you have to live simpler. And the gardening was a way of getting out of that house and spending time outside. And you look at our grandparents or great-grandparents, you know, if we're native or we came over from Europe, the whole life was evolved around harvesting and gathering food. That's what it was. Survival was about. And I think it gets us back to our roots. It really settles us down as human beings. And I think it makes us better socially too, when we're grounded to earth and we see the relationships around us and how we're connected to that.
Yeah. I was thinking back as you were talking to my own, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and my mother tended an enormous garden, and of course, I spent a lot of time in the garden, and that has with her, and that has sort of, I kept that, you know, and I still do it to this day. What do your gardens look like? I mean, do you have a lot of gardens, or what? Explain that.
Yeah, well, back in the 70s, we were really serious about our food and living simple, and we lived on 2,000 a year for 12 years, and therefore we relied on our garden. I mean, we didn't have the money to purchase things like that. And back then, the only way you could get organic food was to buy it, to grow it yourself. So, you know, it was a way of our life. It wasn't a whim. It was really a commitment that we made to sustainability and living simple. And the byproduct of that, being in the wilderness, carrying everything in, you're very aware of your garbage stream. And one reason I wanted to write this book was to give people other ideas on how you can eat without creating this incredible, massive garbage footprint. We're drowning in our garbage. Back then, in over a 12-year period, we produced only 3 cubic yards of garbage. You know, we bought in bulk. We didn't do plastics, period. You know, if you had beer, you had to recycle bottles back then that you could return. You know, back in Wisconsin, beer was that way. So it was really a commitment of a way of life, and it was a serious commitment, and it was just a wonderful thing. Because when your harvest, for example, your turnips are coming up, that's what you eat. You eat all turnips, and you eat with the season. And then we built the root cellar. And when you go into the root cellar in October, November, when it's starting to snow, that whole cellar is just filled with produce from your garden that you live on during the winter, along with your apples and that. So it's an incredible way, and I think a lot of people now are aspiring to that. And we have a major climate crisis that we're in, and it's going to get worse. And the solutions to this is really getting back to the simplicity of sustainability and not wasting stuff and wasting our money when we're buying packaged goods and all the extra consumption that we're doing that's not necessary. So it's going to be a way of the future, and people aspire to it, fortunately, because it's the way that human beings are. They're close. They have these relationships with the earth, but we're so disconnected now. And the great thing of solutions to climate change is the social engagement and engagement with the world around you.
Talking today with Will Steger and Rita Mae Steger, who are the authors of the cookbook, The Steger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. And we haven't really gotten into the recipe book or the cookbook, but we will coming up. You can join in with your questions or comments. Have you visited the Steger Homestead? Questions about it, how Will has managed to build and construct this wonderful set in this wonderful setting, some beautiful buildings, and as literally thousands of people have come to visit over the years. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're with us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at some simple recipes for an abundant life with our two guests today, Will Steger and Rita Mae Steger, authors of the cookbook, The Steger Homestead Kitchen. Questions for them about the book, about cooking, or maybe about the homestead itself. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Rita Mae, I had so much fun going through the cookbook. I really enjoy the stories of Will's adventures. But I also am intrigued by many of these recipes. I haven't tried them yet, but I will be trying some of them for sure. How did it first come about?
You know, we've always casually talked about making a cookbook at the homestead, but we're friends with Beth Dooley, and we all just kind of thought, yeah, we should do this together. And she basically followed me around with a notebook, and I contributed some of my grandmother's recipes on my dad's side, Will's mom, and some from my mom as well, and also recipes that are homestead favorites.
And tried them all out of, because a lot of your cooking, and this is something I've always enjoyed too, cooking for large groups. I look at one of the photos on the front page is a table. It looks like it would seat about 25 or so people. So anywhere from 25 to 100, maybe. It's always a lot of fun for me to do it. It must be for you as well. But the recipes themselves, they're sort of adjusted for the size, are they not? of the crowd?
Yeah, the recipes in the book are just kind of standard, like 4 to 6 person servings. But when I cook at the homestead, I am cooking for about 25 people 3 times a day. So I'm doing a lot of math in my head, lots of multiplying of 3.5 tablespoons. How many cups is that?
And I tell you, the writing, I want to just comment on the writing because it's so nice. And there are some great tips things I hadn't thought about. So, for example, you have a red cabbage and celery salad. And how you describe it, this is a dish of brilliant contrasting colors, magenta, deep green. And then you say, use your fingers to massage the oil and vinegar into the cabbage leaves. This helps them become tender. And I had never thought of that.
Yeah, definitely want to put in some elbow grease into that. You can also use that same technique for kale, basically any brassica. So like a broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage. It just helps like the flavor soak into it.
Yeah. Well, would you talk more about, people are interested a bit more in the Steger Wilderness Center. Can you describe who comes, what do they learn, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the Steger Center, it's basically, we're still in the construction stage, but we're doing pilot programs now. The main effort is going to be bringing in high-level leadership policy makers in that wilderness setting, because it's that inspiring setting and inspiring community and food where you really can get into that space where you need to relax and to make these big decisions that you're going after. We also we're doing pilot programs now for what we're calling the School of Sustainability, which is taught by a lot of the people, men and women and different cultures that have learned their trades and learned gardening and so forth there. They're now making their living at it. Our instructors, we also have master instructors that are in the field or retiring. So we have a real tight teacher instructor ratio to 3 to 1, and we're teaching various skills. It can be log cabin building, stone building, basic things like this. We don't have our gardening courses down yet, but that'll be in about 3 years from now. And a lot of what we teach is job ready. Some people come because they want to learn for skill-based job ready education. Others people come because they just want to learn a new skill, or they might be building a cabin. They might be doing something on their own like that they want to enhance their learning in a certain field. And you can go on our website, which is really simple. It's stegercenter.org, or just go Google out Steger Center. You'll see the website. We're building up the website, and we'll be putting online soon, next week, actually, the courses that we're going to have offered. There's limited space right now. We're going to build it out more in the future. I also work with projects in the inner city of Minneapolis, and these are a real hardcore skilled learning, because the students are on a 20-week course in the north side of Minneapolis, and then we're part of that we're 2 weeks of that 20-week course. And at the end of that 20 weeks, then when they graduate, they're placed in good-paying jobs, 23 to 25 an hour, in construction. So, I mean, it's a way of bringing people out of poverty. There's so much, as you know, as people know, and trying to hire people, there's so many opportunities out there right now for everyone. And the society needs skill-based learning as we go into our clean energy economy. We have to replace the infrastructure. This is a real opportunity I've been waiting all my life for. So we're doing a lot of that type of job-ready, I call it job-ready skill-based education. And those are pilot programs also.
Rita May, let's take a closer look at the book, which I always love a cookbook that has great photos as well as great writing, and yours certainly done. But how is the cookbook itself organized? Describe the various parts of it.
Yeah, so there's, I don't know, it's like 7 or 8 chapters. Starts with the garden, And then there's Simple Comforts, Fireside Feasts. There's The Pantry, and a few other ones I can't remember off the top of my head, honestly.
Well, there's, yeah, and there's everything from, from baking to, and how do you do your baking, by the way? What's
In
the
our
oven like
Thanksgiving
at?
oven.
What's your oven like?
What? I don't know what exact year it's from, but it's old. It's very special. The pilot goes out a lot. One funny thing I've had to do is harvest a stick long and skinny enough to light on fire to light the pilot at the back of the oven. Stuff like that. The kitchen at the homestead is full of character, and I love it. There's just a old collection of plates and mugs, and
And so, and you feed visitors from all over the world. And I'm thinking about my own times where I've cooked for large numbers. A lot of the times I've been cooking for people who are all from the same kind of location or more or less. What about cooking, finding recipes that and food that no matter where you're from, you're going to enjoy?
I'll make at least four different dishes to put out, but I always make sure that there's something comforting, something familiar to anyone who's there, whether they're from a different place or if they have different dietary needs. I just always try to make it as inclusive for everybody as possible, and also just try to present it nicely too.
You shared with us, and we have it up on our page, ideas at WPR.org/Larry. I believe it's up there right now. It's your homey tomato soup recipe. Tell us about it.
There's a lot of tomato soup recipes out there, but I really like this one because what makes it creamy is a roasted cauliflower that's blended into it at the end, and it just gives it the best, silkiest texture. I love heavy cream and dairy, but in this particular tomato soup, the roasted cauliflower gives it a really good texture and body.
Yeah, it looks great. I hadn't thought about using a cauliflower that way, but it must give it a little different taste too, doesn't it?
It makes the color a little different, but the taste is pretty much tomatoey.
Yeah, it's tomatoey, but there's a just a little different taste, so there has to be. Well, now I'm going to admit something to you, and this was before I knew that you had said we could go ahead and use that tomato soup recipe. I made my own tomato soup at home, oh, about a week ago, and I put this nice steaming bowl on the table, right next to your cookbook because I was going to go through and I went back to the kitchen to get a glass of water, and when I came back just as Tiger, my cat, jumped up on the table and knocked the tomato soup over the top of, of
That kind of day.
your. Oh my goodness. And I can attest to the sturdiness of your cover because
That's great to hear.
I jumped up. Well, I was already up, but I ran over, grabbed the cookbook, took it to the kitchen, turned on the faucet and ran the water over the cover of the book. And you know what? I can show it to you. Can see it. Will can't see it, but I can tell you that it was perfectly cleaned off, and no one will know except the 100,000 or so who are listening that there was tomato soup all over it. Oh my goodness me! I had to tell that story. It was I laughed, and then when Jill let me know that, oh, you're giving us a tomato soup recipe. I can hardly believe it. Oh, tell us about your turkey burger recipe. You have a couple of unusual ingredients in it, from page 58 of your cookbook, I believe.
So the turkey burger is no knock against like a regular hamburger. Turkey meat can be kind of dry. So in this recipe, I added in some mayonnaise and a mashed avocado, and the fat makes it very juicy and moist.
Oh, yeah. So you just grind that in with the, oh.
It has a really good flavor at the end.
I would like that a lot. So there's another one I'll be trying. What's your process for developing? You know, how do you come up with this idea, with these ideas? What's the process you go through?
I don't know. It's really just what's inspiring me in that moment. Also, if there's a recipe that sticks, if I get a lot of good feedback from it, or if I just really enjoy it, I will keep cooking it at least once a week just because it's good to eat. And then eventually, in the end, I have a recipe. And even now, some of the recipes have already changed because I'm still cooking them and I'm always tweaking them.
Well, I think it's a great process, and I want to ask about some other ones that caught my eye. But Will, we got to go back to the annual ice ball, which I thought was a pretty cool thing. Talk about that process, that ice ball.
Okay, we've been cutting ice for refrigeration in Ely since 1967, and this is something 100 years ago. I mean, before electricity, that's all there was ice. So this is a standard thing where you cut ice in the lake. In our case, we got about 50 people that come up for the weekend. It's always the first weekend of February when it's nice and cold. And we have four working horses that come up to haul the ice that we cut from the lake to the root cellar, to the ice house. And then from there, we stack it. And that ice is kept in sawdust in the ice house, and then we're able to use that all the way through the summer. I mean, it's still there in December, and then when the next winter comes in. And we never use any fossil fuels on for refrigeration, combination of that ice. And then the other room is the root cellar, which is a standard, just a cellar that's cooled down by the temperature of the ground and the earth, which is usually around about 45 degrees.
Yeah, it's a quite a process. And actually, you wrote that the thickness of ice has changed over the years. So maybe climate change affecting what you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's climate change is affecting things across the board. And, of course, when you're doing something consistent like that thickness of ice, when lakes, particularly when lakes freeze up, it's really noticeable that the lakes are freezing almost 3 weeks later than they used to. The breakup in the spring is... It's very, very variable because sometimes there's ice on opening season of the fishing. You know, that's our second weekend of May in Minnesota, or it might open at the very beginning of right around this time, beginning of April. So that's reflected, of course, in the ice thickness.
Yeah. So there's just another sign about how things are changing. Rena May, back to you. I'm just back to the cookbook again here. What are, where do you source your ingredients from?
We get them from our garden, lots of vegetables from there, and from our local farmers market in Ely every Tuesday, and from bulk ingredients from local co-ops in Minneapolis that we'll get.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about that operation, and Will was mentioning buying in bulk. It's at the time when you got started, Will, it was probably a lifesaver in terms of cost, because things were in bulk like that are much less expensive per ounce.
Yeah, that's very true, and things are still available in bulk. If you look, you know, where you get the organic food, I buy oatmeal, buy 50 oatmeal every day, so I get by the 50 pounds. I eat rice and whatever grains and beans I eat. A good meal. I like to eat it all the time, so I eat. That's one advantage of eating simple like that. But it's amazing how you cut your costs down just enormously, whereas eating and costs of eating can really bankrupt the family budget. But if you buy in bulk and you're thoughtful in how you eat and what you grow, you can reduce your costs by almost 75% if you're careful with that. And you're eating much better that way too, much more, it's healthier. And so I'd really encourage people to buy in bulk. And you're buying at some co-ops too. You can buy there. You don't have to buy a 50-pound bag if you don't have room for storage, but you can. There are bins, and you can get 10, 20 pounds at a time. And that's a really good strategy. If you're eating almonds or whatever, hazelnuts or whatever your choice is, you can also buy that in bulk and then keep them fresh in the refrigerator.
Your a lot of the recipe or a number of the recipes in the book came from your mom, Will. When it comes to food, what did you learn from her?
Well, I learned a lot about patience from my mother. She cooked for 10 people, and she came from a farm herself. So, and her and her sister, 10 kids, they were the youngest, so they did all the cooking. And everything was from scratch, of course, all the desserts, everything. You didn't buy in a box back in that day. But I was always interested in cooking, so a lot of times I would hang out in the kitchen. My mom would show me how to, you know, make bread and cookies and dough, and some of my fondest memories that we had, we touched upon this, is I used to work in the garden with my mother when I was a child. I was probably 3-4 years old, I can remember that. Not only was I in love with the flowers and that, but it was really nice to be, touching moments with your mother at that time. So, and I started my first garden when I was 8 years old. The parents allowed me to, you know, dig up the back lawn for whatever size garden, and I'll never forget that seeds out there. I'd get up, you know, 5:30 in the morning before school and check the seeds and nothing growing. And then I think it was about the seventh or eighth day, these nice rolls of radishes came up. It's just almost like a miracle.
Oh, man. Well, I'm looking through the book. You've got the garden, simple comforts, then homestead gatherings, a section, and then fireside feasts, the homestead oven, the wholesome treats, and the pantry. Those are the various sections of your book. And fireside feasts, I mean, is there anything better than cooking on an open fire in the out of doors? Rita May, I was looking at your pan-roasted fish with herb butter, and I'm...
Yeah. It's so good. The recipe is so simple, and... yeah, we hang out by the fire a lot. Our little, there's a little hangout zone by the lake. It's called Hobo Village. And we all go down there after work and we have a huge fire and we'll make hobo fries, which are French fries, and grill some fish or make some corn.
Well, there is nothing. The best meals I think I have all year are the ones that, where we're, say, musky fishing or something, and then you pull up on an island and get a little fire going with some panfish that you've caught and just pan-fry those, and they're so good. They're really good. So that whole section intrigued me. But then I was also seeing some of the results of your travels and your experiences. I looked at a Vietnamese steak salad with hard-boiled eggs, for example. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's one of my favorite recipes. My mom makes it for me all the time. It's steak that's marinated in a little fish sauce, and you hard-boil some eggs and some tomato and sautéed onions, and eat that over some rice. Yeah.
And it's so it's simple, but that it looked just every one of the dishes looked.
Well, that particular picture in the cookbook, actually my mom cooked that and made it, and I needed a picture of it, and so she sent that to me. She is really good at cutting fruits and vegetables and making them look very ornate.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And a couple of others I just wanted to mention. One, the focaccia. I looked at that photo and I just wanted to eat the photo. I mean, it looks so, so good. And you say it's so easy.
Yeah, yeah. If you can follow some directions, really, and just, like, have patience, and it's all worth it in the end.
I'm making that one for sure. And the other one I'll just mention in passing, and this is probably because of my ignorance as a chef, but you talk about zucchini bundt bread, and I had never thought about making zucchini bread in a bundt pan.
I know. It just kind of elevates it. You could probably put banana bread in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought of that right away. I thought, yeah, Andy, get my bundt pan out and try it that way.
You could try meatloaf in the bundt pan. I don't know.
Well, this has been a lot of fun talking with both of you today, and I really appreciate it. And I really am enjoying your book, and all of the and the stories that are kind of mixed in from Will's adventures, and that all comes together to make for a really interesting story connected with the recipes you have. So, Rita Mae, a big pleasure. Will, thank you so much for being with us. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And I hope we have a chance to do this again sometime. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. Sorry.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Good to meet you as well. Well, Will Steger. And by the way, Steger is spelled S-T-E-G-E-R. So there's only pronounced Steger, but it's with one E, S-T-E-G-E-R. And if you go to their website, which we have up on our page, but you just type in Steger Homestead into a search engine, and it's going to come up. Their book, again, is called The Steger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. And the recipes look great, and the stories behind them look wonderful as well. You know, there's another story that I think is pretty cool, too, and that has to do with a product that's often used in food, and that's vanilla, the scent of vanilla. It's something I love, and a lot of other people do, too. And our next guest is a professor in the Department of Botany, Ken Cameron, and he's going to talk with us about vanilla and the plant that it comes from and some of the problems that are now associated, perhaps, with the plant's existence. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.